Well, from the voice of the great Rod Stewart, that Auld Lang Syne was recorded at Stirling Castle in Scotland. I am Kelly Elbin, along with our executive producer, Jenna Self, wishing all of you a very happy new year. Let's make 2026 a fabulous, fabulous year. Thank you again for making Musings on Golf a great 2025 for us. In this encore performance, Dr. Bob Rotella, the noted mental guru, I guess you could say, for so many terrific players at the elite level, but also for just a lot of people who've wanted to be better at the game in general. People who have, you know, were good players, but maybe needed that little extra nod up top between the ears. He's worked with countless numbers of people, he's helped so many. And we had Dr. Rotella on March 19th. It was just after Rory McIlroy had won the Players' Championship in a playoff against J.J. Spahn. And Rory, right at the outset of the press conference, he credited the time that he had spent with Dr. Rotella, that had had a huge influence on him. And certainly Dr. Rotella's influence carried over a month later when Rory, in as dramatic a fashion as possible, won the Masters for the first time, thereby becoming the sixth all-time to win all four of golf's major champions. Dr. Rotella, just an incredible amount of respect for him. Bob Rotella was also a very good player. He still plays the game a lot, but obviously most known for what he's done for the elite players of the game. And we talk a lot about that. Brad Faxon's name comes up in this interview. He's worked a lot with Brad over the years. I still remember a story from the PGA Championship in 1995 where Brad was really grinding the last couple of days because the PGA Championship that year was the final qualifier to get into to make the U.S. Ryder Cup team. Brad played poorly on Saturday, called Dr. Rotella that night, and basically Bob Rotella just said to him, look, just go play the golf course tomorrow at Riviera as if nothing matters. Just put it out of your mind completely. Do your best. We've talked about this. Just go out and play. Don't think about anything else. Just enjoy the experience. And voila, Brad Faxon, I believe, shot 63 in the final round, made the U.S. Ryder Cup team that year. He talks a little bit, really, not so much about that, but about helping players like Brad Faxon. And certainly at the elite level, folks, there's not a lot of difference between a lot of players. And if you have that mental side, that edge can mean everything between winning and not winning, between finishing in the top 10 or finishing 30th in a given week, between winning $500,000 versus winning $78,000. So hope you enjoy once again hearing from Dr. Rotella. And I know the reason that this was the most listened to is because this is a very relatable interview. People enjoyed listening to this interview with Dr. Bob Rotella, because they are always searching for ways to improve their game. Hopefully there's some nuggets in here that you can glean that will help you in your game as you head into 2026. You'll hear that interview with Dr. Bob Rotella right after these messages from our three corporate partners, William & Harry, Titleist, and the Friars Golf Club. America, this is your moment. William & Harry's limited edition spirit shoe is here, so every fan can feel like part Team USA from the first tee to the final putt. Two head-turning designs, premium deerskin, 100% waterproof with spikeless grip and all-day comfort. Limited run, don't sit this one out. Pre-buy now at williamandharry.com. Get into spirit. Get into comfort. Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Rory, how much work is required in maintaining or improving your mindset? And can you give us a sense of how you try to do that in the next 3 weeks?
I think just, you know, double down on what I'm doing. Double down on the work that I've been doing at home. Double down on the, you know, the conversations I've been having with Bob Rotella, you know, like all that sort of stuff.
Our timing could not have been any better as we welcome in our special guest today. Rory McIlroy noted Dr. Bob's contributions after he won his second Players' Championship on a cold Monday morning in North Florida. Rory and many other elite players, as well as recreational golfers, have been able to improve their mental approach to the game thanks to the great work of Dr. Bob Rotella. His latest, Make Your Next Shot Your Best Shot, The Secret to Playing Great Golf, is, I believe, Dr. Bob, your 12th book on golf that you've authored. What a treat to be joined by golf's foremost psychologist, Dr. Bob Rotella. Dr. Bob, you're here in warm Palm Beach Gardens. Thanks for joining us on Musings on Golf.
Good to be with you.
All right, so let's get right to it. Rory mentioned he's been talking to you. What have been your thoughts and messages that you communicated to him, Dr. Bob?
Well, let's begin with the idea that we're going to try to condense into a few minutes.
I know, it's not easy, right?
First of all, you know, I'm really into the psychology of exceptionality. So I'm a sports psychologist. I'm a performance psychologist. And when I was coaching years ago at the University of Connecticut, University of Virginia, and started studying the mind, I really wanted to work with people who are normal or above normal functioning, who wanted to be awesome or fantastic. So I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a clinical psychologist. I'm not trying to get people to normal. I'm working with people who are already normal or above and trying to get to awesome or fantastic. It's a mental discipline. We're basically chasing human potential. I would say we're trying to get in a great state of mind and a great mood every moment you're on the golf course and you're preparing and practicing, which is, you know, and people say to me all the time, it's really hard to do the stuff you teach, Rotella. And I go, yep, we agree on that point. Yeah. But if you want to be great at something, you're going to have to do something that's really hard. And at some point, everyone's going to learn how to hit a golf ball. Everyone's going to learn how to hit a bunker shot or a pitch shot or a putt. And, you know, and then you get labeled having potential. So these, you know, the people I work with, they're chasing human potential. It's different for people who are told they have unlimited potential than it is for people who all the so-called experts say you don't have any. One person's dying to have someone tell them they have potential, and the other person's dealing with the fact that everyone thinks they have it based on something they've observed. And a lot of my teaching is, well, it's in the mind, it's in the heart, it's in the soul, it's in the human spirit. You can't really take a picture of it, but we pretend we can because we like cameras, you know? And if it doesn't show up in a camera, we almost pretend it doesn't exist. But in a nutshell, I would say we talk a lot about playing golf rather than working on your swing or working on perfecting the game. And the whole point is it's a game and therefore it has to be played at. It's not a game of perfect. And I know that's the title of one of my earlier books, but I mean, the bottom line is it's not a game of perfect. And that came out of the idea that it's a game of mistakes. I think at this point I've had like 82 major winners. And the bottom line is, none of them have won a major on a week the way they dreamt it up. In their dream, they think they're going to pure it on every shot, and every bounce is going to go their way, and every putt's going to be read correctly and break in the hole, and every bounce is going to end up, and it never happens that way. And so some of it is you're dealing with this vision you know, that's promulgated out there, that that's what you have to do, which causes people to get more perfectionistic. So what commonly happens is, boy, I got a big one coming up. I got to be perfect this week, which affects your practice and your preparation and the tension you put on yourself when you play. And I would say we're really teaching people all you have to do is be average. And that takes all the pressure off your game and gets you in a state of mind to go play at the game. And it's always amazing the different ways people win. And it's, you have to come to grips with that, because it's not what the general culture is advertising. I mean, you know, they're going to make it whoever wins. All they're going to do is talk about how good they hit it. And sometimes they do. But you can't depend on it. Let's put it like that. It's like, can you play when you're not hitting it well? So, I mean, this was really a neat week for Rory to be not having his A game, if you want to call it that. You know, I think they said he was like 67th of the guys who made the cut at something in fairways here or something. And it not let it bother you. It's like, well, good. It's going to be, this is going to be a fun week to see if I can score hitting it out of the rough. That's a big part of it. I think part of it is, if you think you have to be perfect, you must think that the other guys are going to be perfect, which is another false idea. And then it's like, we spend a lot of time talking about, be yourself, play your game, do it your way. And I think the other thing I'd say is, we talk a lot about, you got to keep loving the game. When you play the game since you're a little kid, you get your heart broken, you get beaten up. It's like, can you keep loving it? And the other part for pro golfers in particular is, do you let the money start becoming more important than the joy of the game? Like when you started, you just love playing golf. You didn't just love it when you won. You didn't just love it when you shot a certain score. You just love being on the golf course, having fun getting the ball in the hole. And I've talked to him in 89. I spent a whole day with Ben Hogan. And it was so clear when you talk with Ben Hogan that he loved playing golf. And he didn't need anybody else to talk to. You know, it was very clear talking to him. Give me a ball and a club in a golf course and a hole in the ground, and I can have a good time. I don't need anybody else. I don't need a cover. No, other people, they want to have a conversation all day. So everyone's different, but it was very clear, even though we think of him as very quiet and serious, he would really have fun on a golf course. But TV thinks if you're not telling jokes, you're not having fun. So everyone doesn't look the same when they're having fun playing golf. And so I don't care what you look like, but I care a lot about what you feel like. And the other thing I'd say, as a general rule, is human beings are victim of habit. So you better practice really good habits every day. You know, so sometimes people say, so you think it's all in the mind? And I go, God, if you've read any of my books, I certainly have never found any sport where it's all in the mind, but it's a big piece of it. But, you know, I want people to train and have good technique and good mechanics and all that. But then you can get an argument, well, what is good mechanics? And, you know, can you repeat it? But you better have good habits. Mentally, emotionally, physically. But anyways, that's a quick answer.
Dr. Rotella, I understand that Sam Snead had a very big influence on you. Is that true?
Yeah, I'll tell you a couple stories on that. So back in about the late 70s, I was doing a talk in Madison Square Garden to a couple thousand basketball coaches, and Bob Toski was just getting the Golf Digest golf school started, and they were going to usually promote it in the magazine and make it an instruction magazine. And I can't remember if it was Time Life or Time, some like that, owned Golf Digest. And they came to my talk because they felt like if they're going to start these five-day schools, they needed to have someone addressing that part of the game. And they really liked my talk, and they called me up and asked me if I would come down to the Contemporary Hotel at Disney in Orlando and do an hour and a half or two talk on performance psychology to Sam Snead, Paul Runyon, Kerry Middlecoff, Bob Toski, Jim Flick, Davis Love, and I think Peter Costas. The day before I was to give my talk, someone from Golf Digest called me and warned me that Sam Snead was probably old school. He was like 60 or something. And he was probably going to rip me to shreds. And I remember going, oh, great. You know, that's going to be good. And I went and gave my talk. And when I finished and opened it up for questions, Mr. Snead stood up, and I'll never forget it, because the first words out of his mouth was, I hate to think how many U.S. Opens I would have won if I had you to talk to. And he basically spilled his guts talking about how when he was like 19, he had a chance to win the Open and messed it up coming in the last four or five holes. And he said, I carried that with me in every U.S. Open I played with for the rest of my career. And he said, it didn't affect me in any other tournament, but I convinced myself that I messed up my best chance and let it slip, and I would probably never win one. And then he just went on and started telling story after story about the role of his mind and emotions in the golf game. And I've always said, I don't know if anyone else would have asked a question if Snead stood up and said, the mind and emotions have nothing to do with the game of golf. And we ended up having two and a half hour discussion about it. And what happened from there is they'd have 5-day schools. And Snead and I would come in on Wednesday and give a talk after 10 hours a day for 3 days of golf instruction. And we would give it, and then on Thursday and Friday, we would take them 3 groups at a time out on the golf course and try and teach them how to take what they learned on the range. I caddied as a kid, but I played mainly team sports growing up and in college. And I'm just learning golf at that point, basically. And I'm getting to spend whole days, you know, with Sam Snead on the golf course, talking about how to take it to the golf course. You know, he just had so much personality and so much stories. It was a lot of fun. It was a neat experience for me. And we got along really well and had a lot of fun. And, but Snead was, you know, he was a special man. He was full of stories. He liked my stories and I liked his, and we got along just fine. He grew up in kind of the mountains of West Virginia, and I grew up in Rutland, Vermont. We get along real fine. He's a good guy. But anyways, that's where that story comes from.
Dr. Bob, without that credibility from Sam, might you have never possibly have gotten your career launched? If Sam, and as you said, if Sam had said something differently, would your work have been different?
Well, I don't know as I would have ended up in the game of golf. I already had a career. I coached lacrosse at the University of Connecticut for 6 years and 3 at the University of Virginia. And I had coached high school basketball. I played basketball and lacrosse in college. I'd been around sports and I had a pretty good following. And actually, when I started working with golf, I had been playing tennis for 10 years and doing a lot of work in tennis and ran a junior academy while I was teaching and coaching at Virginia. But yeah, I don't know what would happen to me. You know, I always say, I wonder what would happen. I don't know. And then I guess the other influence was very early on in my career, around that same time, actually David Ledbetter called me up. He had come to America with Nick Price and Dennis Watson. And Nick and Dennis were better players, so David was going to teach and they were going to play. And Dennis, you know, they left Zimbabwe, and I think you could take a couple $1,000s. I could have that wrong, but something like that. And Dennis had, from what David told me, Dennis had 6 tournaments left. If he didn't make $55,000 or $60,000 in those 6 weeks, he was going to lose his green card and have to go back. And he was scared to death. And he asked if there's any way Dennis could come and spend some time with me. He came and spent 2 or 3 days at my house, the Friday, Saturday, Sunday before the Buick Open. And we just spent 3 days. I didn't charge him. I just thought this would be cool. I'd have a great time talking about this, what I knew. And Dennis left my house on Monday and ended up beating Mark O'Meara, I believe, in a playoff. He took 2-3 weeks off because now he had his green card taken care of. Called me up and asked me to come back again. And he came back again for a few days, a few weeks later. I remember setting him up with one of my grad students for a couple of dinner dates. And he left and went to Las Vegas and won. And then I went to Sun City with him for the $1 million tournament. And then I started, Peter Costas had me spend some time with Tom Kite and Gary Koch and Roger Maltby, and they started winning. And anyways, then my career cut. And then Pat Bradley came and saw me and she took off. And then pretty much word of mouth led to a career in golf. But yeah, you know, people ask me, what was your goal in working with golfers? I said, I didn't have a goal of working with golfers. I love sports since I was in 5th grade. I grew up next to the Catholic high school, and I was at every practice in football, basketball, and baseball every day, shagging balls, rebounding, doing whatever. And it kind of led to a career in it. I think I was just very early on recognized, because when you coach, you quickly, there are gamers and there are practice players, and it's like, you got to get kids to be able to free up and play. And a lot of my life is getting people free up. freed up, and so they can play and do something they've already seen themselves do in practice.
No, it's such an honor to be joined by Dr. Bob Rotella here on Musings on Golf. Dr. Rotella, you know, when coaches the swing of a student, you're able to see results fairly quickly, at least on the range. But when you coach someone's mindset, what their thinking is, I've got to imagine that's a different process in terms of how the results come to be. What is that process like for you in working with someone to help the mental side of their game?
Well, you know, when I start with people, they usually come to my home for two full days, one-on-one. We do marathon sessions. I try to teach them everything I want them to know. And then as you get to know them over time, as you stay in touch with them and, you know, discuss things, you kind of learn what people's tendencies are, and, you know, and you kind of simplify it more and more, and you learn to, you know, what's this person need? And every, you know, some people want to win. Some people want to win more. Some people want to win majors. They've won regulars and they've won majors. Some people, it's their driver. Some people, it's their putter. Some, it's their pitching. You know, but everyone's got something. Some people have trouble going low, but boy, they don't ever shoot over 74. Some people, you know, can shoot low, but if things don't go their way, you know, they blow themselves out of the tournament. So, I mean, everyone's a little different in what they need to work on, or what they need a little more help on. But, you know, it's, you got to keep getting better because the competition's unbelievably good. I mean, obviously, people who are teaching the swing or the whatever part of the game technically are doing a pretty good job because a lot of young people can really hit the ball. But now they got to learn how to play golf. You know, like if I went back to Tom Kite's generation, they learned how to score, and maybe 28 or 30, they started becoming pretty good ball strikers. Today, the kids learn how to hit the ball first, and it's really, a lot of them hit it really good, but they don't score. And so what they get for feedback all the time is, how could you shoot over par hitting it the way you hit it? Well, the answer is, it's really easy. You know, so I'm really into, it's possible to hit it good, but you have to learn how to score good. So playing good is scoring good. Hitting good doesn't necessarily relate to scoring good. And you have to understand that as a part of it. I know it's probably something you want to talk about, but I mean, when I was a kid, I caddied. You know, I won a candy bar sale in fifth grade, and I got to caddy on a Wednesday, which was doctors and lawyers days. And I lucked out. Bobby Locke, the great South African champion, married a girl from my hometown of Rutland, Vermont. So Bobby Locke spent a lot of time playing there, and I was a really good athlete. The caddy master set me up. And, I mean, actually last year I gave a set of Bobby Locke's clubs to the Rutland Country Club to put on display there. But Bobby Locke was an unbelievable putter. So, I mean, think about, you know, sometimes you get some good breaks. Sometimes you take advantage of them. But Bobby Locke, most people would say, was the greatest putter ever. Brad Faxon's first year on tour calls me, and we start working. And for the next 15, 20 years, Brad becomes one of the best putters in the world. Then Denny McCarthy goes to the University of Virginia, and I start working with him. And Denny's been probably the best putter on tour. And, you know, so we don't have a lot of questions. Now, it's interesting. They don't all do it the same. But I would say they're all pretty darn unconscious. They're pretty much all unconsciously reacting to the target, whether you want to call it target-oriented or, you know, a blackout or a whiteout. But they're seeing it and doing it. Now, Locke, he had a great line. People would ask him, and he'd say, well, I just see it and hit it. And they go, well, don't you want to see it if you make it? He said, I don't need to see it if I make it. I can hear it. And then some genius at the club would say, well, don't you want to see it if you miss it so you know how it breaks on the next one? And he'd look at you with this incredulous look and go, why would I want to see it if I missed it? You know, well, you think how brilliant that is. But they've all have unique way. They all do it differently. They probably all aim differently. But, I mean, they could all putt. And at some point, you have to really love putting if you want to be a great player. And you have to, I call it party time when you get on the putting green. This is where the fun has to begin. This is where you want to kick butt. Because it's, you know, it's like you can either love it or hate it, and you're not going to get where you want to go if you don't love it.
Dr. Rotella, earlier in the interview, you mentioned Brad Faxon, certainly regarded as one of the great putters of all time. In your opinion, what makes a good putter an average putter as opposed to a great putter? What's the difference?
Well, first of all, they really like the putt, you know, and so a lot of time, put it like this, there probably haven't been anyone who would ever be labeled a great putter who also led the tour in ball striking, you know, because what happens is you get a lot of short putts because you pitch it up close. So most people who are really good putters are also really good pitchers. You know, that's part of it. But if you're Jack Nicklaus and you're hitting a lot of greens, they're going to try and tell you you're not either a good wedge player or not a good putter. But if you go look at all Jack's majors, you know, he's a pretty good wedge player, pretty good putter. You know, I mean, Rory's really good. But you know, it's like guys on tour that are labeled not good putters, if you, as an amateur, go out and play with them, you'd think they're an unbelievable putter. So everything is relative. But you better love putting, and you better have a lot of imagination. You better be able to trust your green read. And then you get into the discussion, well, is it the ability to read greens, or is it to think you can read greens? And then it's, you got to have really good speed control. But, I mean, it's an attitude. It's a mindset, and it's a piece of the game. And the way a lot of young people are brought up on ball striking first, they get a lot of negative feedback. You know, so it's easier if you're the player who's always getting positive feedback, because people can't believe you just shot two under par hitting it the way you hit it. But that really means they don't understand golf. I mean, the best, if you go back to Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson, great ball strikers, I mean, they probably average about 12 and a half greens. So, I mean, even the best, they're missing 6-7 greens a day most of the time, and they get it in the hole, you know, and that's what you have to do. And Brad and I have had a lot of fun together spending time with Rory, and he's becoming, you know, he's obviously, he's been a really good putter for a long time, but he's really learning to really like putting and having fun with it, and you know, it's getting simpler for him, and it's, but I mean, it's a really important part of the skill. It's funny, I work a lot in basketball. It's like the tournament's on right now. I think something like in games in basketball decided by 5 points or less, something like 95% of the points scored in the last 5 minutes of a close game are free throws. And free throws are kind of like putting. It's kind of a not exciting to the public. You know, it's a free throw. It's a putt, you know. But it really wins most tournaments. You know, as Rory said in one of his interviews, you know, if on Sunday he doesn't two putt from 75 feet, if he doesn't make that 5.5 footer on the last hole, well, you don't get to go to the playoff. You know, it's just the way it always has been. You know, they don't write a whole lot of books about Bobby Locke's swing, but boy, they like to write about his putting. But if you caddy like I did, Bobby Locke could hit a draw all day. And by the way, it's very interesting. In his book, at the end of his book, Bobby Locke picks the all-time best player for every club in the bag. And the only club he gave to Ben Hogan was the putter. So Bobby Locke, who everyone says is the greatest putter of all time, he picks Ben Hogan as the greatest putter of his generation. And when I asked Hogan about it, Hogan said, oh, well, you don't win championships if you couldn't putt. He said, what everybody talks about is I quit when I couldn't putt anymore. But in my prime, I was a really great putter. You know, but I thought it was fascinating that Locke picked him as his best putter of his generation. But that's not what you hear. Well, all I know is I've had a lot of fun. I mean, there's a side of me that can't believe that I've got to spend my life, you know, the last since late 70s, working with so many great golfers. And you know what's beautiful about that? I have never walked up to a player ever in my life and told them they ought to come and see me or spend time with me. So when they call me, they're ready to talk about this stuff. But what stands out is to deal with the stuff we talk about, you have to be honest with yourself. And players that I work with have been unbelievably willing to be honest with me. which to some degree, you know, I'm fully appreciative of the fact that they've trusted me enough to be honest. It's to some degree why I don't do a lot of social media stuff. It's like, I'm into players. I like players. I like helping players do great stuff. And I want it to be about them. And, you know, I get to spend my whole life helping people chase their dreams. And I don't know why that's what excites me, but that's what excites me. And to me, I kind of see myself as I still see myself as a coach. I just coach the mind and the emotions, and I don't do the other stuff anymore that I used to do when I coached those other sports. But it's been a lot of fun, and I'm still having fun doing it, and I'm thrilled to death that people keep calling and want to spend time. So we're having a good time, that's for sure. Dr. Bob, let's focus on one player in particular. It's not a player necessarily people are going to recognize the name. A former student of yours by the name of Matt Chagrou. Matt Chagrou is one of the top senior amateur golfers in the country. I grew up playing golf with him at Bethesda Country Club outside of D.C., and Matt has had a terrific career. And I reach out to Matt every now and then for some questions, and him being a former student of yours, he sent me something back about the Chip Yips, and he said he went to you, was having a problem with that. And that's plagued a lot of players. Bernhard Langer had a problem with a lot of elite professionals. And he said he went to you about 20 years ago.
Yep.
And he said that you helped him understand the mechanics of his mind, specifically the need to be a good, what he called downloader, what you call a downloader. What does that mean? Is that to download and get rid of the negative and only accentuate the positive? And maybe elaborate a little bit on what that means and how that mental approach can help every kind of player, Bob.
Well, you know, what's really interesting about it is when you're doing it your best, you're really not thinking. Yeah. Like when I hear people talk about mindfulness, I go, it's really should be mindlessness, not mindfulness. We're trying to get the mind really quiet and really emptied out. We're just casually looking where we want it to go and doing it. I remember years ago, I had a guy in the Champions Tour going through the same thing. And I took a 2x4 and I rolled the balls down the 2x4 and I made him hit pitches over a bunker on a moving golf ball. And as soon as the ball was moving and he didn't have time to think and he was just reacting to the ball, oh, I mean, he hit every pitch so good. And he was in absolute amazement. And so a lot of it is getting people to understand, I want you to unconsciously react to a target. I don't want a lot of time between looking and doing, because that's what most people do is they go from the target back to the ball. And instead of reacting to the target, they turn on their conscious brain and try to instruct themselves. Or like you mentioned, you know, am I getting rid of negative thoughts or am I getting positive? I'd really like you to not have negative thoughts or positive thoughts. I'd like you to just look and do. Because that's like, if I'll give you a basketball example. Like, no one shoots a basketball and goes, I got to make this one. And no one, any good, says, don't shoot an air ball. They just look and shoot. That's really what we'd like you to do. That's what it means to believe you already know how to hit a pitch shot. Most people who have the yips, well, first of all, in today's world, you could go online and you could probably find 30 different ways to hit a pitch shot. And everybody thinks their way is the only way of doing it. And yet I've seen all kinds of people. Like the guys at my club will say, well, how does someone, you know, how do all the guys on tour hit a pitch shot? And I go, which guy? And their descriptions of what they're doing is so different. So, I mean, we use the term getting out of your own way. You know, at some point, you got to get out of your own way, which means get your mind out of it. That's what's interesting about, we're called mental coaches or mind coaches, and we're actually trying to teach you to not think and just see it and do it. So, I mean, it's funny. Steph Curry says his mind is spacey when he shoots the basketball. That's how quiet we'd like it. And our language isn't very good for describing not thinking. But every great athlete is just reacting to a target. And a lot of people in golf seem to think if it's a really important pitch or putt or shot, I should take a lot more time and go from the target to the ball and then start instructing myself to make sure I do everything correctly. And that just doesn't work. And the problem is you might be able to make it work on a practice range. And so to get back to our first question about Rory, we talk a lot about the fact that a driving range is okay for skill acquisition, but it doesn't have anything to do with playing golf. If you want to learn how to play golf, you got to spend a lot of time on a golf course. There's a lot of golf courses that don't have practice facilities, and they still have really good golfers. Most of the Irish kids grew up in really windy, cold, wet conditions. Didn't spend a lot of time on the range. You know, so, I mean, it's you got to learn how to play golf if you want to be a really good golfer. If you want to be a good range player, well, then spend all your time on the range or just play it on a golf course. And it's probably the only sport that we don't actually practice where we play. Like basketball, you practice on a basketball court. Tennis, you practice on a tennis court. Swimming, you practice on a swimming pool. Golf, you practice on a driving range. Good for selling memberships, not necessarily for learning how to play golf. It's good for learning some skills, but there's no fear. There's no doubt. There's, you know, that so you got to understand that that's what golf is. It's a game.
You talked about Steph and clearing out the mind. If my memory serves, 1995 PGA Championship, Dr. Rotella, Brad Faxon at Riviera Country Club, it was the final point getter, if you will, for the Ryder Cup team. And he was openly talking and saying, man, I'm struggling. I've got so much damn pressure on myself. And he later said that you told him, believe this to be correct, going into the final round, look, just don't even think about anything. Just play as if you don't care. And he went out and shot 63. I think he finished fourth, fifth, made the Ryder Cup by just a few points. Is that correct? And is that something that it can still be applicable to a lot of players of just kind of wash everything away?
Well, let's say it's very applicable to anybody who's been dreaming about winning at a certain level their whole life, mm-hmm. who cares about it a lot, who thinks about it morning, noon, and night, has put millions of time and energy and hours into it, wants it more than anybody could ever understand. For a lot of the players I work with, they have to downplay it, they have to underreact everything, and they have to play like they don't care and it doesn't matter. Could I find a lazy, good-for-nothing bum that wouldn't be what they need? Yeah. I mean, there's other people. You know, you got to care a little bit more. You know, you got some talent, but if you're going to chase your potential, you're not going to get there with the effort you're putting in it. So, I mean, it's different for different people. But I would say the majority of people that I work with, yeah, they got to move in the same direction as Brad. And I mean, I've seen what Brad can do when he's in the right place. You know, you get to see these guys can play, but they got to let themselves. They've seen it either in the practice area or in a practice round with their buddies, or they've had a day in a tournament where their head was in the right place. And they know, wow, I've seen myself do this. I want to learn how to let myself do this when I have a chance to win or make a Ryder Cup team or whatever. And you know, Brad's got a lot of imagination, a lot of creativity. He really gets the whole idea of having fun and enjoying it when he's in his prime. I remember, I think he won the Australian Open or something. And the week before, I showed him a video of Tom Watson beating Greg Norman at Butler National. And on Sunday, Watson was behind. It was like in the 84, 82, somewhere in there. And Watson did not hit a fairway or a green and came from behind and beat Norman in the playoff. And I showed Brad that video. And he went over there with, oh, God, you know, let's just have a ball. And that's a lot of what it's about. That's the game. The tease, the temptation is you start peering it on the range and think you ought to be able to do that all the time because you do it on the range, you ought to be able to do it on the golf course. I said, well, that's something people made up. There's no rule on that. You gotta find what you need to do on the golf course. You gotta find what works when you're nervous, what works when you're prejudiced. I mean, some people think it's all about you gotta be totally calm. I'm like, you know, if you wanna be calm, play lousy on Thursday and Friday and tee off at 7 a.m. every weekend, and you'll be calm. Get in contention, and you're gonna be feeling some butterflies. You're gonna have some stuff going on. And you got to be able to play with it. If you have to be the winner to feel like a winner, boy, it's really hard to be the winner. So sometimes you learn a lot about winning, even when someone beats you by a shot, because, man, I learned I can get my body to do what I want it to do, which means I was able to get my mind in a place that allowed my body. So, I mean, that's what we're chasing. The wins are fantastic. We love them. The world kisses our butt and tells us how wonderful we are. But sometimes we're feeling like a big-time winner, even when we're not the winner, because we learned a lot about ourselves. And ultimately, that's what makes us happy. But would we like to do that and get the win? Yeah, that would be preference.
Hey, Dr. Bob, two final questions from me. What did you talk to LeBron James about?
Well, you know, the first thing he said to me is, I want to be the greatest basketball player in history. And I was like, okay. And what's getting in your way? And he basically said, I'm not a good three-point shooter. I'm not a good free throw shooter. And they want me to be the captain of the team. And the guys are 6 to 8 years older than me. And I don't know how to do that. And so in terms of being the captain, we talked a lot about Bill Russell. I mean, I grew up in New England when they were winning 11 world championships. And I thought he was one of the greatest leaders ever. Michael Jordan. We talked about different kinds of leadership, and they led very different ways. Part of it is you have to accept the fact that they want you to be the leader, and you're going to have to take that on because you can't win by yourself in a team sport. And then we talked about, you know, this would be very brief, something like you got to make 250 threes every day off a hard dribble, stop and shoot, imagining the best defender in the league is guarding you. And you got to make 250 a day. If it takes you 6 hours, it takes you 6 hours. If you make your first 250, you're done. Then you got to make 250 off a hard cut and catch doing the same. And then you got to make 100 free throws every day. And we put a routine together, just like we do with golfers, and get a really good process that you do to the point where it becomes automatic. And then we made videos of him making threes off a dribble and stop and shoot and off a catch and shoot, videos of his free throws, and said, well, if you really want to be great, this is the stuff you have to do. And what's impressive about LeBron, even now that he's a lot older, he's still so disciplined. And I would say you'd see the same thing with Rory. I mean, Rory's in unbelievable shape, unbelievably disciplined. He's out there every day, you know, practicing every part of the game. He's become a much more complete player. And if you think about it, Rory was a bit of a prodigy. LeBron was a bit of a prodigy. And they have the right combination. They have gift, and they love the thing they're gifted at. And then they combine it with unbelievable mental discipline to get up every day and still love it. And, you know, the guys who can do that can last a long time if you keep doing it. And I think we're going to find in this generation coming up that golfers can play golf for a long time if they take care of themselves mentally and physically. But they're two good examples. It's a fascinating thing. The other funny part of the LeBron story is a year later or two, I'm at the University of Memphis with Coach Calipari, and we're talking to the team, and Derrick Rose is on the team, and I give a talk for an hour and a half to the team. And I'm driving away with Coach Cal, and Derrick Rose calls and says, is Raquel still here? Can he come back and talk to me? And I go back and sit down in the room, and what can I do for you? He said, I want to be the best basketball player in the world. Let's talk. And 2 years later, he was the MVP. He was the rookie of the year the first year and MVP of the league 2 years later. There's a level of desire that you have to be able to deal with. When you want something that badly, that's where the not caring. So for them to not care, we're just trying to tone it down. I mean, the desire is so strong that it causes you to want it too bad and try too hard sometimes, and you have to be able to manage that, and you have to understand it.
Hey, Dr. Bob, last question for me. It's a little variation on a question I asked at the end of every podcast. If you could pick the minds of three great golfers who you never had a chance to work with, who would they be? You mentioned Hogan, so I'm going to discount Ben because you talked to them. Who else?
Well, we'll discount Steve because Byron Nelson would probably be up there. I spent time with Jack's kids, but, you know, I know Jack quite well, but we've had discussions, but I've never really got deep into his head. He obviously, in my mind, is the greatest player. Tiger obviously would be pretty darn interesting. I think Walter Hagen would probably have been really interesting.
Is that because how he went about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bobby Jones really, I mean, Walter Hagen really played the game. Yeah, I mean, he hit it all over the place. You know, he kind of said, I got a slide and a shift and a slide, and then he'd grin and go kick your butt, you know? The truth of the matter, I think the other thing that would be really interesting is to study all the late bloomers who became great golfers. We tend to be, you know, in love with people who were child prodigies who kept loving it and got better and better, which is one kind of impression of impressive stuff. But I think, like, I've got to spend a lot of time with Tom Kite and Pat Bradley. Boy, I'll tell you what, they're in my mind two people I admire so much, it's unbelievable. Because Pat never won a state amateur, wasn't an unbelievable college player, and by at 30 started becoming a great champion and winning majors and doing unbelievable stuff. And Tom Kite, you know, he grew up in the same club that Ben Crenshaw, 2 years earlier, was beating him every time they teed it up. They just kept getting better and better and better. I think you can learn a lot from those people. Probably the most of us can identify with them more. You know, we may not have their discipline, we may not have their desire. But I mean, I think there's something he said. You know, I probably have learned a lot from late bloomers that really had to work their tail off. Because the other thing they have to deal with is they don't have somebody every day telling them how great they're going to be and that they have unlimited potential. And you got to believe in yourself long before anyone else believes it. And that's a different challenge. The other people, they're dealing with the pressure of potential. You know, everyone, if they don't play great, everyone's like, God, how could you not play good? You know, they're like, you know, just different ends of the spectrum.
What if John Daly came to you? What would you, and said, Bob, I need your help. What would you have done?
Well, first of all, a long time ago, I spent 2 days with John Daly. Dean Beeman told John that he wasn't going to let him back on tour unless he spent some time with me. So I did spend a couple days with him. And I'll tell you what, probably has the biggest heart. In terms of swinging the golf club and trusting it and putting and pitching, probably already does a lot of stuff that I teach. I think he got into some bad habits in high school. If you look back, if I remember this right, his dad was a foreman, building nuclear power plants. And the wife would go with him on the road for weeks on end. And John would be left home with his older brother who liked to drink. And he got in some really bad habits at a young age. But in terms of having a big heart and giving back to charity and helping other people and being a good dad to his kids and stuff, John's a sweetheart. And I was pretty impressed with where his mind was at. I mean, John Daly's not filled with fear and doubt. He doesn't have a lot of that. He's got a lot of imagination and he's ridiculously flexible. You know, the way I put it is for John Daly, life is probably harder than golf. I can't even imagine life being harder than golf. If someone asked me, oh God, golf is way harder than life. God, life is a piece of cake, you know? But I mean, there are people who have it the other way. But by the way, I gotta mention this last thing. I had a player this year named Lewis Brown win the U.S. Senior Amateur, and it hasn't got the publicity I think it should get. It's the only medal play tournament he played in the entire year. He's in the World of Finance in Atlanta. And he won the U.S. Senior. The only medal play round he played was the qualifier for the senior amateur. And it got a little, they mentioned that it's his only medal play. I'm like, no. This is, you're playing people that play 30 to 50 tournaments a year. And basically playing tournament golf is way bigger than their job. And they're playing tournaments nonstop. I think he played one member guest, which was a match play. And won it by a good margin. And I thought, that is one of the most amazing accomplishments. And I've worked with a lot of amateur champions and senior amateurs and British senior amateurs. But I thought that was absolutely incredible.
What allowed him to do that?
Well, I mean, we spent a lot of time talking, but I'm bringing it up to you because I suggest you probably do some musings on golf with Bruce Brown.
Right.
But, you know, I think he can tell you probably better than I can tell you. But... And now this year, he's got to figure out, he can play in all kinds of stuff. he's trying to figure out what he's going to do and going to play in more this year. But I think that's an unbelievable story.
Good.
And that's why you got to love it. And you find out if you love it, because if you don't, you'll say, I don't want to get there because it's going to break my heart. So you got to be able to deal with a lot of heartbreak because the world doesn't understand it. And, you know, if you win, you're wonderful. And if you don't, they want to tell you everything you did wrong. And sometimes you did a lot of really good stuff and someone else just beat you. And there's a big difference between giving the tournament away and getting beat. And, you know, you have to be pretty honest with yourself about that. Podrick Harrington told me the first time he ever told me he was going to win a major was after missing the cut at Augusta. And he basically said, I now know that I can do this because it didn't go my way today, but I now know I can get my mind in the right place and let my body do what it knows how to do. And that's a big piece of it.
Our friends at William and Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William and Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee, more control with your irons, more spin with the wedges, and more opportunity to shoot your lowest scores.
Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club. Well, as we close the year, we thank Dr. Bob Rotella once again for being with us again back in March. And we thank all of our guests. It's been a fabulous year, as I mentioned in our Christmas show, kind of outlined who we had and what made 2025 so special. One of the guests, by the way, who we had in 2025, Johnson Wagner. Nice to hear that Johnson is now joining the CBS Sports golf team. He will do a great job for them. Wishing everybody again a very happy, happy new year. Thank you for making Musings on Golf part of your life. Look forward to bringing you many great individual storytellers and stories in the coming year. Have a great and safe New Year's Eve. Enjoy the golf that's coming up. Enjoy the college football playoffs and the Super Bowl. Get back out on the golf course when you can. I'm in Florida, so I'll get back on the golf course right away. But wherever the weather might be a little bit cold, get to that simulator, hit some balls inside, work with your PGA professional over the phone even, get some tips, get yourself ready, because before too long, spring will be springing, and the Masters will be on its way, 2026. Happy New Year from Janice Self and Kelly Elvin. Thanks again here on Musings on Golf.